is Writing from Hand to Hand, a dialogue on Lewis Hyde's The Gift with Amy Hassinger and Fred Arroyo, recorded for Radio Free AWP 2011. Part 2, continued. Your letter reminds me of a quote that has fed me, from Thomas Berry. In the 20th century, the glory of the human has become the desolation of the earth. The desolation of the earth is becoming the destiny of the human. All human institutions, professions, programs, and activities must now be judged primarily by the extent to which they inhibit, ignore, or foster a mutually enhancing human-earth relationship. The historical mission of our times is to reinvent the human at the species level by means of story and shared dream experience. That's from Berry's book, The Great Work. Berry calls himself a geologian. He is a Catholic monk and scholar who has spent his life studying Aboriginal societies and ecology, and who has written for years about his own very hopeful vision of the future. He believes we are in a time of transition, that we're entering what he calls the ecological era, and that in order to get there, we need to reinvent the human at the species level, to begin to see ourselves as part of the Earth's ecological systems, rather than separate from them. Berry's vision, happily, includes poets and writers, that those of us who spend our days dreaming are essential to shaping a healthier future. It seems to me that Hyde is talking about the same thing, without Berry's specific agenda, when he says, "In this way, the imagination creates the future," and when he identifies gift exchange as an economy of recreation, conversion, or renaissance. Through this gift exchange, then, we, writers and readers, artists and receivers of the art, are dreaming the future into being. I have, on occasion, thought about what my life would look like if I gave up writing. What would I do then? I think the most immediate reincarnation would probably be that I would become a full-time mother and homemaker. There are aspects of this that I find appealing, but I tend to imagine this life in a hyperbolic way. I imagine that if I quit writing, I would somehow transform into the proverbial supermom, suddenly finding within myself great reserves of organizational power, the desire to volunteer more often at my kids' schools, the ability and sufficient passion to grow a lush organic garden, producing enough food to feed our family. I would become the ideal mother, invested with infinite patience, living only for my kids, etc., etc. And while at first, if I'm particularly frustrated with my writing, this fantasy can seem appealing, as I think about it more, I can almost feel my heart caving in on itself. Because I know that I would be rejecting what I consider to be the essential things, as you put it, Fred. I would be rejecting the gifts of my own soul to itself and to the world. And to do that feels like courting death. So I appreciate your putting it this way for me, that by choosing to write, I am choosing to gift to others what increases life, and in this way, I am also increasing my own life through the shared dream experience that writing and reading is. I reread the pages you mentioned, 144 to 152, and I can see why you find these to be among your favorites in the book. I was especially moved by Neruda's story about the man emerging from the coal mine, who took his hand and said, "I have known you for a long time, my brother." What a validation of a life's work. And this, it seems to me, is what Hyde says Whitman was writing for as well. The seeking for love, yes, but also the seeking to be known, to be truly seen by a sympathetic stranger. It's so interesting, too, how Whitman saw the gift of his poetry as, quote, arousing streams of living, pulsating love and friendship directly from them to myself. Hyde points out that the direction seems wrong here, from them to myself. And yet Whitman was clearly energized and inspired by the idea of an audience, of people reading his words and loving him for them, even after his own death. And this vision of his that so inspired him, that kept him working and living, despite what was a paucity of love in his own life, did indeed come to pass, dreaming into the future. Finally, I want to highlight these words of Hyde's from pages 150 to 152. In Biographia Literaria, Coleridge describes the imagination as essentially vital and takes as its hallmark its ability to shape into one, an ability he named the esemplastic power. The imagination has the power to assemble the elements of our experience into coherent, lively wholes. It has a gift. An artist who wishes to exercise the esemplastic power of the imagination must submit himself to what I shall be calling a gifted state, one in which he is able to discern the connections inherent in his materials and give the increase, bring the work to life. In order to sing in front of other people, for example, the singer cannot step back and listen to his own voice. He can't, that is, fall into that otherwise useful frame of mind that perceives the singer and the audience as separate things, the one listening to the other. Instead, he must enter that illusion that he and the audience are one and the same thing. The gift is lost in self-consciousness. This passage of Hyde's seems to me to cycle back around to the Buddhist ideal in a way that seems on the surface contradictory. We must be awake to experience and yet self-forgetful, asleep to self, at the same time. What does this mean? I think, of course, and Hyde seems to say this too, that this is the small self we are forgetting when we write. Ideally, the grievances, discomforts, and little demons of desire that constantly invade our stillness drop away when we are in the writing zone, and we are able to access a larger self with whom we are in communion and for whom we write, ultimately. This is the soul that we wish to delight in the workshop, and it is the soul who is connected with all the other souls that might someday receive the gift of our work and be delighted by it.
Dear Amy, first I must apologize for taking so long to reply to your wonderful, thoughtful letter. I sometimes just don't know where the time goes. I always want to set aside good, quiet, attentive time for work like this, some ideal sense of time, only to then find it never arrives and I get farther and farther behind. And now, at this time of the year, the papers continue to arrive and I almost feel overwhelmed when I look at them stacked so thickly in folders. Going to the AWP seemed to be a bigger event of change this year. I went for 4 nights, didn't do any work at all, and arrived back incredibly exhausted. At the same time, I was quite rejuvenated. It's odd that I often find the AWP disconcerting. Too many people, too much strange energy of people trying to get ahead. And so I end up attending my events and then heading off into whatever city. This year was different in that now the amount of friends I have is growing. So I roomed with a good friend from California, and I spent a good amount of time with Charles Fort. Also, I decided to talk to folks as I saw them. And this was one of the best AWPs I've attended. Let me begin with a story from the AWP. You received the poem and film I sent from Kim Stafford, a very fine writer I've admired for some time, and who I gravitated towards because he is the son of the late poet William Stafford. The second morning of the AWP, I left a panel. I just had a feeling it wasn't right for me, and made my way to the book fair, where I saw Kim stepping on the escalator next to me. I hesitated, and then introduced myself. We had a long, intense conversation for 30 or 40 minutes. We shared stories, writing we were working on, and I spoke of the importance of several of his books, and one that I've taught several times. The conversation became very emotional and centered on the power of stories, and his eyes started to well up and his voice became choked. Memories and stories taking us to farther places. We talked of work and our fathers, how we recognize certain qualities in their gestures, in their work. Before we parted, he told me of the dichos, brief Spanish proverbs or sayings he shares with students so they might begin writing from the dichos they have heard in their own families. All these supposed fragments of language, what Stafford calls the muses among us, become the gifts that shape our sense of language and story. He told me of a longer one about a priest, a doctor, a lawyer, a teacher, and a storyteller on a sinking ship. There is only one life preserver. They discussed the merits of who should have it to live. The doctor needs to live because he will heal the sick and save children. The lawyer helps to make the laws that keep society intact and just. So he should live. The priest should live, of course, because he provides spiritual answers of hope that the people need to continue living in the darkest of times. The teacher should live without doubt. They offer our children knowledge and skills that help them become the people they dream. But the teacher doesn't want the life preserver and offers it to the storyteller. We need you to survive, the teacher says, because we need you to tell our stories. Kim Stafford says to me something like, "You are that life preserver, Fred. You are the one to tell our stories." It was strange and moving. I want to say, though, after reading your letter, Amy, that in each of these moments there was something like a gift present. There was something like soul shaping our conversation. And what was present, gift, soul, is much larger than me, greater than anything I will ever accomplish. And that is the way it should be. This morning, this story returned to me because of the conclusion of the gift. Hyde writes, "I think a gift, and particularly an inner gift, a talent, is a mystery. We know what giftedness is for having been gifted, or for having known a gifted man or woman. We know that art is a gift for having had the experience of art. We cannot know these things by way of economic, psychological, or aesthetic theories. Where an inner gift comes from, what obligations of reciprocity it brings with it, how and toward whom our gratitude should be discharged, to what degree we must leave a gift alone, and to what degree we must discipline it, how we are to feed its spirit and preserve its vitality These and all other questions raised by a gift can only be answered by telling just-so stories. As Whitman says, the talkers talking their talk cannot explain these things. We learn by faint clues and indirections. In part, I realize I return to this passage because it highlights so much of the day-to-day process of trying to be a writer, the give and take of leaving our gift alone, as well as the discipline we bring to it. That our gift is nurtured not just by the process of creation and the sharing of a product. It has a vitality from deep within our beings, and regardless of all these things that try to squelch or kill our gift, we have to take measures to preserve it. We have to feed our gift from those sources of plentitude, life, nature, spirit, literature, art, music, that speak to us and charge us with a distinct tierra or terer, an unmistakable flavor or gusto. I also return to this passage because I'm beginning to realize I don't want to explain or know exactly what gift I may or may not have. Yet I do want to contemplate and know possibilities for making something from that gift. And thus, I want to learn each day how I can continue to nurture that gift. And perhaps this is obvious, but I'm learning more and more of the relevance of sharing just-so stories. They are pieces of lore, pieces of practice and passion, accomplishment and failure, idea and dream that help to affirm and provoke the life of the gift I don't quite own. In these stories I'm remembering from the AWP, for instance, I want to recognize the power of friendship. Or given how you helped me to see more clearly the process of soul-making, Amy, I want to recognize a communion beginning to take place. The stories are not explanations. They don't answer how-to questions or technical matters. In a way, then, the stories are insubstantial if it not for the faint clues and indirections within them. It is as if through these just-so stories, we can restore mystery back to the mystery of our writing. Perhaps this has been a way to work towards your focus on a veil of soul-making. I really appreciated your highlighting of this. After my initial reading and reflection on the gift, I continue to return to a feeling for the making of soul. I've always thought that what writing does best in its most profound moments is to rise to the level of music and architecture. That is, when a piece of writing moves me in unexpected ways, beyond that wonderful vivid dream of inhabiting another world, I feel as if my insides fill with some palpable physical presence, the music filling and lifting my chest and bones, the large inside spaces of a cathedral rising inside of me. Again, that gift we receive. And as you point out, this experience is what we take with us into the kiln of the second gift, labor, craft, to create a third gift to offer to others. But this soul-making, as you suggest, Amy, becomes so much more, that we write first for ourselves, that our primary goal should be to write the kinds of books that we ourselves would want to read. And the fact that by laboring to please ourselves, we are simultaneously enriching the world speaks once more of the interconnectedness of souls if you are inclined to think that way, or of all matter, even. It is doing an essentially religious work. It is reconnecting, rebinding experience with meaning, linking the chaos of constant sensory inputs with the serene understanding of the soul. You offer wonderful insight into the gift. It is not an individual talent or possession per se. The gift is realized in an individual the more it becomes a part of a larger soul. Whether the individual writer is aware of this or not, I'm not sure if I know exactly what I want to say, but you describe here to me a view of writing that takes a great amount of pressure, expectation, or demand off the individual. Because when writing is something we do out of pleasure, not a pleasure that is shaped solely by experiences, objects, taste, values outside of us, when we are truly writing for ourselves, when we've recognized the gift's existence within us through pleasure, joy, wonder, astonishment, we are beginning to temper something through the inner connectedness you describe. And that energy is neither here nor there, but in the reconnection, rebinding, and linking of pleasure gifted from various locations, the commerce of gifts, if you will. Why even begin with what is outside of us? We must begin from the pleasure alone in the workshop. It is the soul itself, the artist's labors to delight, as you highlight. Can our writing, our gifts, help others to reconnect or bind again what is most essential to them? Yes. Yes, I have to say. I hope I'm not being selfish by saying I appreciate our discussion greatly. And I love to arrive at moments like this when the dialogue speaks to you in compelling ways. You write, "And while at first, if I'm particularly frustrated with my writing, this fantasy can seem appealing. As I think about it more and more, I can almost feel my heart caving in on itself, because I know that I would be rejecting what I consider to be the essential things, as you put it. I would be rejecting the gifts of my own soul to itself and to the world, and to do that feels like courting death. So I appreciate your putting it this way for me, that by choosing to write, I am choosing to gift to others what increases life. And in this way, I am also increasing my own life through the shared dream experience that writing and reading is. These choices you've highlighted, Amy, I want to keep close, as well as your letter. There will be more to turn to, as I need to continue to dip into the gift. I guess I have no choice but to be selfish, because our exchanges and conversation has been very enriching. I want to do something new and challenging and gratifying. So in a few weeks, I leave for Maine, the White Mountains, where a poet is gifting me a cabin for 25 days. It isn't a super long time, but I know when I get there, I will be ready to labor in the delight of the soul, because this reading and writing we've done will nurture my writing, Amy.
Writing From Hand to Hand was produced by Amy Hassinger and Fred Arroyo. Excerpts from Bruce Coburn's song, The Gift, are used with permission.